find theirs.
My landlord's the bank. What are you talking about?
You want land?
Let's not even waste any time. We got a long packed episode today. It's episode 78, PH Fantasy. I'm Tony. I'm here. Ryan. He's here.
Hello.
Shane. He's here. And we have a special guest, Hunter. Hunter's here. What's up, buddy?
Howdy.
He's off the grid right now, actually, on vacation. Because now, anytime you're not in your house, you are off the grid. Yeah. So let's just hop in. We'll do our 78s. And then we got a pack show. I'm not even going to waste any time telling you what to expect from this pack show. So let's just.
It's chunky.
Yeah, it's the thick
I'll,
boy.
I'll start with I when I came across this name, I was like, holy crap, Yellowstone. So I found the original John Dutton. I don't know if you guys watch Yellowstone.
I don't.
Okay.
I don't,
the main I don't character the main character is named John Dutton. I thought I'd get a lot more rise out of you guys, but apparently you guys don't watch that show.
No, it's really fun. Like it's like a complete like conservative fantasy of like having guns and getting to use them on people all the time, but like for cool reasons. Like you're protecting your cattle and your family.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. Cattle.
Yeah.
So Mr. John Dutton, NFL draft 1974. Round one, overall pick number 5. Went to Nebraska for college. 6'6", 266-pound defensive lineman. He played for the Baltimore Colts and Dallas Cowboys. What I also thought was cool about this is the Yellowstone show takes place, I believe, in Wyoming. And this guy was born in Rapid City, South Dakota, which is on the border of Wyoming.
Sick.
Ryan is geography, man. I love it.
Geography facts.
That's right. He's close to the Devil's Tower.
Oh, naturally.
He's in the South Dakota Sports Hall of Fame, which is probably not that hard to get into. Like I said, he was the 5th overall selection in the 74 NFL draft, drafted by the Baltimore Colts. 1976, he led the team with 13 unofficial sacks and 73 tackles.
Ooh.
Yes, he was also part... That's right. 3 consecutive seasons in which the Colts won the AFC title from 75 to 77. He was a starting member of the defensive front four who collectively called themselves the Looney Tunes. And they all, a.k.a. the Sack Pack.
Dorks. Fucking dorks.
Theater kids, dude.
Right?
Do trenches still give each other nicknames? Is that still a thing? I haven't heard like a...
I don't know.
They should. Yeah. We should bring it
they
back.
They should, yeah. We gotta bring that back.
Yeah.
But this is just a short guy. This is just a short one because I thought it was cool he shared the same name as that guy from Yellowstone. Mr. John Dutton.
There you go, John Dutton.
I love when we can encompass our lives into the show, too. It's important.
Oh, I got one for that. But you want to go next, Shane?
Yeah, I got a pretty short one because I know we're chunky today. So I'm back this week with another event, but this one's more known than the cake farter or the driver full of bullets. So the 78 is the play known as the Holy Roller, or to us Charger fans, the Immaculate Deception, which is a play on the Immaculate Reception. So I'm not too sure if this is a chicken or the egg circumstance of when this franchise became cursed to be the receiving end of highlights and prolonged history of good but not great. We actually might have built a stadium on stolen land and ended up cursed to hell like Ernest when he went to camp.
Oh, God.
Foreshadowing here.
Oh, God.
So the Holy Roller took place on September 10th, 1978 in Week 2 versus the San Diego Chargers and the Oakland Raiders. In true Chargers fashion, we choked the momentum in the fourth quarter, and the Raiders were on the 14-yard line with 10 seconds to go with one play to go. So initially, things looked great. Raiders QB Ken Stabler is getting sacked for a 10-yard loss by Woodrow Lowe, but then chaos reigns with Yakety Sax playing in the background, where Stabler may or may not have moved the ball forward while the ball was coming loose.
Totally
Raiders
did.
Running... we'll get to that. Raiders running back Pete Banaszak then leans over to pick up the ball, but also ends up having his fingers greased, and he hot potatoes the ball into the end zone where Raider tight end Dave Casper also hot potatoes it before he lands on the ball, giving the Raiders the proverbial win. According to the NFL rulebook, if a runner intentionally fumbles forward, it is a forward pass. During the play, Jerry Markbreit, the main referee for the game, was positioned behind Stabler, and they ruled that Banaszak and Casper's actions were legal because it was impossible to determine if they intentionally batted the ball forward because he was directly behind them. Which would have been ruled as a penalty. It took 40 years for Stabler to admit his guilt and say the ball was intentionally thrown forward and it was a fumble. He quote, "I did. I mean, what else was I going to do? Throw it out there, shake the dice." And honestly, dude, as a human being, I respect the hell out of that. Bend the rules and make them prove it.
True.
So Banaszak and Casper also admitted they moved the ball intentionally forward. So now there's implications, because what the hell does a week two game actually matter in the spectrum of things? So if the season remained the same with every other single outcome of every other game in the NFL, the Chargers would have ended up making the playoffs, as they would have beaten the Oilers in week 16 in the tiebreaker game to advance the wild card. This game also set the momentum of a poor start of the Chargers season, which led to coach Timothy Prothro resigning and Don Coryell taking over and making a massive turnaround in momentum, as well as a playoff. Yep.
Wait, did you say Don Corleone?
Close. Organized crime is for the other episodes.
We're going legit.
Yeah, for real. There's no Florida mattress gangs around here. So they make a playoff run during 79 through 82, and we also would have not ended up drafting tight end Hall of Famer Kellen Winslow. For the Raiders, nothing would have been different because their season was ass. So the aftermath of this, the Chargers fans made shirts which showed a referee being blindfolded and the football bouncing across the end zone with Immaculate Deception and big ass letters across. You can actually buy one of these shirts, a vintage one on Etsy, for $60 for a size small. I was tempted. I have a smaller frame, but I couldn't get the distinct measurements. I'm waiting to hear back from them still. So in 1979, the NFL would amend the rules to state that if a player fumbles after the 2-minute warning in a half or overtime sequence or on the fourth down of any time during the game, only the fumbling player can recover and advance the ball. If that player's teammate recovers the ball during those situations, it is placed back at the spot of the fumble unless it was recovered for a loss, in which case the ball is dead and placed at the point of recovery. So now back to our favorite player to shit on, Aaron Rodgers, and how the Holy Roller impacted his career. So when Aaron Rodgers in 2014, in a game against the Buffalo Bills, Aaron Rodgers had the ball knocked out of his hand by Mario Williams. It rolled backwards in the end zone and came to a complete stop. Packer running back Eddie Lacy picked the ball and tried to run with it, but the referee approached quickly, waving his hands to declare the play dead, and after talking to the back judge, signaled a safety for Buffalo. The NFL director of officiating said that since the Holy Roller rules were in place, the only player who could have picked up the ball and the fumble and advanced it for Green Bay was Rodgers, and the safety was called correct. They lost the game and did not have the number one seed in the NFC that year. So,
sucky nice. Packer. Actually, and that was a great one, by the way. Fun fact, the referee of that game, Jerry Markbreit, his daughter and my mom were really good friends growing up.
Really?
Like, yeah, the Markbreits were like family friends. Like I helped his daughter move into her house like 5 years
ago. Oh, that's cool.
And he reffed like a bunch of Super Bowls. He was like a head official for a long time, and yeah, like
very notorious referee.
He blew it. He fucking blew it, man. All right, this one. Okay, so it's time. It's 78 time. So my 78 this week takes us to the 1978 NFL draft. Third round, pick 80. The Rams draft a center from Colorado by the name of. He'd go on to be named to the Hall of Fame, but not the NFL Hall of Fame. He went to the WWE Hall of Fame under his ring name, Vader.
Oh, shit. You did cut out, though, Tony, on his real name. What was his real name? Oh,
Leon White is his real name.
Leon White. Okay.
So there's nothing too unique here for our show in terms of his childhood. From Linwood, California, born in 1955, grew up middle class, threw shot put, wrestled, played football. He was a football player for Colorado, excelled on the offensive line. He was second team All-American center, and he got his business administration degree.
Nice.
After getting drafted, he never played an NFL snap and retired due to patella issues.
And he was the third overall pick?
80th, third round.
80th, okay, gotcha.
It's the hardest sport on your knees.
Right. So he's spotted by a guy at the gym post-retirement, and he's like, "You should be a wrestler." And he's like, "Yes." and he ends up in the AWA as a monster beefy boy heel. He wrestles regionally for a few years under the names Baby Bull and Bull Power. And then shit got crazy when he started wrestling in Japan. He was traded from All Japan Pro Wrestling to New Japan Pro Wrestling. He changed his name to Big Van Vader in honor of a warrior from Japanese folklore. He put a mask on and just fucked shit up.
Nice.
His biggest achievement was beating Antonio fucking Inoki in 1987. Like, that is like the god of wrestling in Japan. After he beat him, it started a riot that led New Japan from being banned from the Sumo Hall for 2 years, which was like their home base for shows.
What?
Yeah. He was the first ever white boy to hold the IWGP title. His eyeball popped out of his head in a match with Stan Hansen. So he just put that fucker back in and held it in with his eyelid. So it's fun stuff.
Hell yeah.
He worked in both New Japan and WCW at the same time. He needed a bunch of eye surgeries. He needed knee surgery. And I don't know if he was like unsafe in the ring or if he's just fucking huge, but he caused a lot of injuries to other dudes. He cracked two of Sting's ribs and then ruptured his spleen. He retired Nikita Koloff. He sprained Joe Thurman's back, but dude, he fucked Mick Foley up. All right. He broke Foley's nose and got him in one match with a cut so bad he needed 27 stitches.
Holy crap.
If you want to take a pause on the viewers to go look at a picture of Vader, he's the epitome of a human bowling ball.
He's beef, man. That's a thick boy. The next week after that Foley match, they had a rematch and he powerbombed him outside of the ring. They gave him a concussion strong enough to take the feeling away from large parts of Foley's body.
Really?
Yeah, but also the next year they were having a match in Germany and part of Foley's ear was ripped off.
Excellent.
The lore was built. So he went to WWE in 96. And he actually might have won the title, but he had an issue with the current champion, Shawn Michaels.
Ooh.
This is the height of his like pill and abusing other humans era. Vader was going to challenge him for the title, and they kind of got a bit at like a house show when Michaels said in the ring that Vader was working him too rough and that he was going to get him fired. So when it came time for their pay-per-view match, there's a spot where Michaels is going to hit an elbow drop and Vader was supposed to move. So Vader forgot. Michaels lands on his feet, tells him to fucking move, and like kicks him for real.
A lot. More than once.
Yeah. Vader just kind of took it since Michaels was like the guy back then, but it absolutely buried him. And also, most importantly, in 1996, he had a cameo in Boy Meets World.
He was in a couple episodes.
Boy Meets World, damn.
Yeah, he was one of the, remember the big bullied kids? He was one of those kids' dads.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was some good Mr. Feeny action in there.
I thought you were going to say, like, he came in and tried to date Topanga and make Corey jealous.
Fucking.
Topanga actually went to my high school, or not my high school, my college.
It all really? Comes full circle, man.
I saw her in a Chipotle line and a Baja Fresh line, and I was too chicken shit to say hi to her in those two times in my life.
What would you have said? Would you have called her Topanga?
No, I wouldn't have been weird. I wouldn't have been weird. I'm sure she'd be cool with it, but I'm like, hey, Danielle, I appreciate your work. Thanks. Enjoy your bowl.
Yeah, what did she get?
I don't know.
Probably got one of those lifestyle bowls.
Probably.
All right, so most of the rest of Vader's time in WWF was forgettable, but there's this hilarious quote that he said to an interviewer, mask versus mask match against Kane, and Michael Cole goes up to him ringside with the microphone. He's like, what has happened? And he said, quote, I made the biggest mistake of my life. Maybe Vader time is over. I'm nothing but a big piece of shit, a big fat piece of shit. Legendary. I'm going to work that into the commercial montage today. So in 1997, when the U.S. was, or when WWE was in Kuwait, Vader went on a morning TV show. And when the host asked him if wrestling was fake, Vader flipped a table and grabbed the host by the tie. So he spends 2 weeks in jail and pays a $164 fine. And apparently everyone agreed to this beforehand except the host who pressed charges. All right.
Person most important.
Shane, this next one's for you. After that, you know, for the next 15 or so years, he bounced around various places. He got into it on Twitter with Will Ospreay after his match with Ricochet in Japan. And they ended up having a one-off match where Vader beat Will Ospreay.
Was that when Will Ospreay was like 85 pounds soaking wet instead of like the big juice dude he is now?
Yes.
That's so fucking cool.
Yeah. So Vader, for a super heavyweight and big time drinker, surprisingly had some major health problems. He had an infection after a knee surgery that put him in a coma for 33 days.
Wow.
Wow. He survived a car crash where he was unconscious for over half an hour. He was told by doctors in 2017 that he had 2 years left to live. He tweeted about it. He regretted tweeting about it and said he'd prefer to die in the ring.
Dude, wow. Did they make the wrestler after him?
Right. So Leon White ends up dying at 63 from pneumonia, but let's just call it for what it is. Vader is a fucking wrestling legend who won titles across the world. And most importantly, is beat both Antonio Inoki and Will Ospreay. That is my 78 Leon White, a.k.a. Big Van Vader.
Damn. Well, and as usual, you know, without intentionally doing something, we actually have something in common with my next guy.
Of course.
It's kind of, it's not as evident as the last ones, but let's talk about Big Bad Jackie Slater. All right.
Oh, okay.
The thing that he has in common is that he was drafted in the third round. Almost close. He wasn't pick 80. He was pick 86. He actually went to Mississippi State in Jackson and actually was teammates with Tony, you could probably guess, Mr. Walter Payton.
Yeah, Jackson State.
He was actually recruited by Walter Payton because he was such a good offensive lineman. Born in 1954, he played, get this, 20 seasons of football, all for the LA Rams.
Wow.
That's a company, man.
Right.
Right?
Wow. He actually has the NFL record. Yeah, he's the only player in league history to play for one single team / franchise in three different cities. L.A., oh. Anaheim, and St. Louis.
Damn.
Yeah. He was also teammates with, I didn't say this yet, but he's in the Hall of Fame. He was also teammates with multiple other Hall of Famers from the Rams era. Merlin Olsen, Joe Namath, Eric Dickerson, Jerome Bettis, Isaac Bruce. In 1986, he was the key blocker for Dickerson. As he ran for a playoff record 248 yards and two touchdowns against the Dallas Cowboys in the NFC divisional game.
Oh, how are you going to fit on our Cowboys fan like that?
Yeah, you know Hunter's a Cowboys fan. You had to, oof.
Shove it in your face. I did not know that. I did not know that. But. Yeah, he was, took the Rams to the Super Bowl, what was that? Super Bowl 14, losing to the Pittsburgh Steelers.
That was the game that was on the screen during Black Sunday.
That's right. Oh my God, another tie-in. What the hell?
Dude, we're like professionals at this.
Right? In 1980, he was part of the Rams offensive line that surrendered just 29 sacks and helped the Rams offense finished second in the NFL in total yards gained with 6,006 yards.
Damn.
Gee whiz.
Slater is considered the most consistent members of one of the best offensive lines in the NFL, which also included Pro Bowlers Kent Hill and Dennis Hara, and was recognized for his work ethic and leadership skills, which is why he's in the Hall of Fame. He retired after the 1995 season when injuries reduced him to playing just one game that entire year. Yeah, after football, he worked for ABC for a little while. He actually got hired by Art Schell to become an offensive line coach for the Raiders. Slater's son, Matthew Slater, played college football at UCLA and was drafted by the New England Patriots in the fifth round of the 2008 NFL draft.
That's his kid, Matthew Slater?
Yeah. He's a gunner and special teams captain for the Patriots.
Yeah, he's made like 12 Pro Bowls or something stupid like that as a special team specialist.
Yeah.
The best in the league.
The Slaters as a family have 17 Pro Bowl nods between them, making the Slater family the third most nominated family in history behind the Matthews family with 25 and the Manning family.
It's nepotism all the way down.
Nepo baby, Matthew Slater.
Right. And he's also an active member of the NFL Play 60 program.
Oh, those kids, get out there, kids.
Yeah, right.
Turn the TV off.
Yeah, get out there and throw the ball around. Touch some grass.
Right.
Get off Discord.
Like I said, he holds the record amongst all offensive linemen who have played the most seasons with one franchise.
That's nuts. That record will never be broken, right?
20 years? By an offensive lineman. I highly doubt it.
Right?
That's really cool to make the Hall of Fame for leadership and work ethic. Just like a Hall of Fame good dude, basically.
Yeah, for the general pieces of shit we cover on this, it's nice to have the other side of that spectrum.
Right.
Yeah.
The Hall of Fame of dudes that should be managers.
Right? That's Big Bad Jackie Slater.
Yeah, there you go. Big Bad Jackie. That was a good round of 78s. And we only have one more offensive line potential. And so we're going to switch from beefy boys.
Wide receivers, baby.
Back to wide receivers. So let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll go to camp. And then we'll go over this rookie mock that we did with Hunter. And goodbye.
Vader. Vader. You wanted revenge tonight, but it didn't happen. What happened out there?
Man, the man usually don't have any excuses. I came here tonight to compete. I got my butt whipped. I made the biggest mistake of my life. I trained. Look at me. I'm so big. Maybe better time's over. Nothing but a big piece of shit. Big fat piece of shit.
Well, ho.
Camp. We're going to Ernest Goes to Camp.
I don't know if I want to go to camp, God. Though.
I didn't realize when we started talking about this last week, I have vivid memories from when I was younger watching all these Ernest Goes to Whatever movies, right? But I guess as being a kid, you don't realize how racist this movie probably is, and that's probably why you can't find it streaming anywhere. You can find every other Ernest movie, except for this one. Shane obviously found it through his movie site. But
Ernest
Goes to
Africa. Good.
It is not.
Ernest Goes to Canada. Bad.
Yeah. It is not on Hulu. It is not on any of your popular streaming sites.
It's a Disney property, so it would be on Disney Plus. Now,
do you think, Hunter, is it?
Yeah. So Hunter is actually unfamiliar with the Ernest schema, so to speak. So Ryan, why don't you educate the people?
You don't know Jim Varney? Oh man.
Yeah, I have no idea who or what Ernest is or what this is.
Delve into some of his films. Let's see. Ernest Scared Stupid was a good Halloween kids movie.
How would you explain Ernest to someone that's never heard of Ernest?
He's just like a freaking idiot who's always involved in something. So in this movie, he's not a counselor, right? He's like the camp like janitor or something. Yeah, camp,
Ernest,
like...
Ernest is like the blue collar worker who looks like he's at the 2014 title fight show because he has like has a denim vest, a plain gray shirt,
a jean vest, and a plain like huge build like hat. Yeah, yeah.
He's a general buffoon, good hearted buffoon
who gets into
hijinks. Okay. So he's like a kind of like American Mr. Bean type of character.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I would say that's pretty much exactly what he is.
So in this movie, basically, there's like a huge construction company who's trying to, I think, buy the camp land, right? And to turn it into something, develop it into something. And it turns out that it's like Indian burial grounds.
You have maybe a really good memory because you didn't even watch this, right? You were just going off of what you recall from your childhood.
Yeah. Holy I didn't watch it yet. yeah, this is all stuff I remember. I loved the Ernest movies when I was a kid. And it turns out that what makes this so racist, I guess, was the guy that they got to play the Indian chief in this movie was known for playing American Native American roles in the 70s and 80s and 90s, but he wasn't even Native American. He was Italian.
He's fucking Italian.
And,
oh my God. I was going to guess he was Italian as a joke.
Yeah. That's great. You know, he just had that Native American look with the olive skin. Cause he was from like Sicily, or he had Sicilian ancestry something.
He's the teardrop guy.
Yes. Yeah, he's the teardrop guy from the trash commercials for the public service announcement.
His full name is Espera Oscar De Corti.
Right, that's Native American.
But he goes by Iron Eyes Cody.
That's right, yeah, Iron Eyes Cody, that's right.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so the opening sequence of this movie, I literally took the first note down. I was like, I need to take notes of this movie because there's going to be a lot of bad things. The opening sequence, I was just like, man, I got to get ready for a lot of casual racism.
Yep.
He did say quote unquote Indian throughout the movie, and there was one scene where he said Native American. I was like, oh, we're fucking learning. Thank God.
I do love the two cooks that recur in like all the movies, and like for some reason this one they're chefs, right? But they're just like destroying food with like this fooderator machine that they have. They just throw shit in and it spits it out, and somehow
They're like the fillers between like the different scenes, and it's like
the comic relief,
a weird ad lib sequence to bridge a scene that doesn't relate to the other.
Right. So the end scene ends with like Ernest learns all this like Native American like spirit guide stuff, and
he passed the trial of the blade.
Right. Yep. He's yeah, that's right, and he's able to dodge arrows. Or no, gunshots. Sorry, gunshots. He's able to dodge bullets. Not dodge, they just don't hit him. Because the spirits are protecting him. but the reason we started talking about this movie is because that's a famous movie that Lyle Alzado was in. And
he looked mean in this movie. Like, I was like, he's going to fucking kill somebody for real on this set.
I was telling Tony, did you remember the scene where they're like evicting people of properties around the camp area, and his famous line from that movie, he's talking to the guy who owns the construction company. They show up on the site, they're trying to evict this house, and he's like, they're still in there. And then he just goes in there and starts throwing shit around, tells the family to get out. He's got a gun pointed at him, and he just like swats the guy, and he goes against the wall and like, get the fuck out of here.
Did you know that Lyle Alzado actually broke Jim Varney's nose on the set during the filming of a fight scene?
Really?
That surprised me at all. There was weird tension between them whenever, like for the minimal time they're on screen. I was like, there's got to be some weird background things here.
Varney said that the crack that you hear in the movie is not added in production.
Dude, really?
Jim Varney's a badass.
Dude, I mostly just like looked at the IMDb trivia. You want me to give you a couple?
Sure.
Okay, since 2017, Montgomery Bell State Park was filmed at holds a celebration of the film in the summer called Ernest Day, which includes an outdoor screening, games and activities such as an Ernest lookalike contest, there's your title fight show, a turtle catapult, hikes, crafts, archery, face painting, and attendance from various members of the production.
That's right. I forgot about the turtle catapult, and they put little parachutes on the turtles. So when they shoot them up in the air, they come down, and then they snap on your nose.
When we get our first sponsorship, this is what we're putting our money into. We're going to put our money into going to this festival.
Tony, where is it filmed?
Where's
Montgomery State Park?
Montgomery Bell State Park. I don't know geography, man. You tell me.
I don't know.
But like, there was actually, I don't know if you guys saw this. There was an issue with the turtle parachute scene that like the director was like, I want actual turtles to be parachuted into this scene. And the studio was like, you will harm the animals. And his response was, it's only funny if you see their legs wiggling. and so wait, hang on. So they were like, all right, so the studio made a bunch of turtles with wobbly legs for the parachute scene, and the director said fuck it and put some actual turtles in there anyway.
That's funny.
I'm not directing more movies, whatever.
Right. Where is it, Ryan?
Were the turtles okay?
Right. So this is actually, it's kind of far for Shane, but it's not that bad for you and me, Tony. It's actually about 50 miles outside of Nashville.
I'll hop on a plane, bro. I don't care.
Hell yeah. Ernest Fest, baby. And it's weird because we're talking about how it's not streaming on Disney Plus, and it's been pretty much like written out of canon because of how racist it is. And these, right. This tradition that started in 2017 is like, now we're doing it.
Dude, they're going to drink Bud Light at this festival, too. They ain't taking the fuck. They're not letting liberals set the fucking precedent.
We're going to go, and we're going to be made very uncomfortable with how often people are laughing at the racism.
I don't think Bud Light is allowed in Tennessee right now.
Right? The last thing I have to say about Ernest Goes to Camp is there's a bunch of trivia on IMDb, and then there's one that's just dropped in there, and it's one line, and it says, much of the film's dialogue is improvised.
That makes sense.
I hope it's true. I fucking hope it's true.
Nah, we'll just wing it. It's fine.
Yeah.
Hey, know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's half the fucking script.
Well, that's what, Shane, when you're talking about like ad-lib scenes, I'm like...
Well, that's why that like half of the bits that happen in the movie, they aren't bits. Like the episode or the sequence with the skunk, he just runs around. There's no skunk on camera. He's just being weird. And then they just end the scene. And like half the skits aside from the killdozer scene at the end, they insinuate something happens and you're just like, okay, as an adult, it's hard. But as a kid, I guess it's like, oh, he's just being goofy.
He made a bunch of movies and there's a basketball one too. It's Ernest and Rim or some shit.
There's like 20 of them. Yeah.
So Ernest, there was some. I have a list of some of the ones that didn't make it in. If you want.
Okay.
Ernest in Paradise. Ernest the Bellhop.
Ernest, I don't remember any of these.
Ernest. Well, none of these got made, but these were ones that were proposed at some point.
I think Dunstan checks in stole the Bellhop bit.
We got a real diehard Under Siege deal going on here. And the two that I say for last that were written but not made was Ernest versus the Space Commies from Hell.
What?
We got to make that movie.
And Ernest and the Curse of Hitler's Brain.
All right. Maybe not that one. There was a Holocaust joke in this movie. I didn't write it down, but there was like some.
Yeah, the Mengele joke, right?
Yeah, and I was like, what?
What does he say, Ryan? What's the line? He's like, I hurt the baby. I'm joking.
Yeah, that was.
I don't remember that.
That's exactly what he said. It was really bizarre.
It's early in the movie, too. They hit you with the Joseph Mengele joke in the first 10 minutes.
It's note number 6 for my my notes.
Shane, do you have any highlights before we move on and talk about this mock?
I will blast through my notes that I took. So opening scene made me really nervous for casual racism. I wanted that camo camp hat because I'm a slut for camo. I would definitely pass the trial of the blade for sure. Ernest is anti-vax. There's a Holocaust joke. When they show up with the kids, it's heavyweights for the rad kids. You know they definitely bladed.
It's heavyweights. This movie is fucking heavyweights.
Yeah, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Heavyweights is way better, though. So he has a different philosophy from Joe Dirt of life's a ditch, dig it, as opposed to Joe Dirt's positive life's a garden, dig it. Pretty sure he made the same boldly goes where no man goes before, and Ernest Scared Stupid. Oh God, yes. Oh no, Ernest is gonna fuck this deal up so bad. Most of the bits are either rushed or not shown on the screen. Very weird to watch. Oh shit, Ernest's musical segment. It's a skip like Cheer Up Charlie and Charlie and Chocolate Factory. A much better musical sequence happens next, and when they make the Killdozer. The main lesson I learned from this is to beat capitalism. We don't need a due process or court. We need to firebomb shit.
As white people, exclusively.
Ernest goes to camp.
Italians.
Oh, yeah.
Italian representations through the moon. So that was a fun little project. So let's talk about a project we did this week. We did a mock draft, and so it was the four of us. And so, Shane, we were kind of talking. Tell me how you want to lay this out.
I mean, we can go through our each individual picks, because it was Tony is 101, me is 102, Hunter is 103, Ryan is 104, and then we repeated. And then we can kind of talk across the guys we liked, the surprises that we picked, why we picked certain people, like Tank Pig Bigsby, Quentin Johnson, and where they were at, general trends, like you saw, the kind of things that shocked you in regards to the mock, because this was a 7-rounder that I just found on Twitter, and I was like, okay, more than one round is beneficial to me as a sicko, and I think this is kind of our first pre-mock, our only mock before the actual draft, because I think it's kind of a weird thing to do when we don't have landing spots or draft capital. It's just like a fun thing to do, so we can just kind of blast the first ones.
You know what, the prevailing logic on this show has been Anthony Richardson 101, no matter what, if you need it. And so I went Richardson 101. I took Levis at my second pick because of the way the board fell.
He also went four to Indy, which is like a really good landing spot.
I agree. And so Shane went Bijan 102.
To Tampa Bay, pick 19. I know we talked about last week of Rashad White, but if he's best player available, I guess so. And then if you follow the mock two that we had, it was like they went like O-line for five picks. So,
right,
Hunter. Yeah. Do you guys want to like talk about the mock draft, like the mock draft that we're basing this off first? Because it's kind of different from a lot of the mock drafts out there, which is kind of what made our mock interesting, I think. Because it's kind of a best case scenario for fantasy, right?
Yes, correct.
So you have four QBs going 1, 2, 3, 4 right away. You had Richardson going to Carolina, Stroud to Texas, Young to Vegas, and Levis to Indy at 4. And then beyond that, I mean, everyone. Then how many? What is it? 5 first round receivers,
which is insane.
Not going to happen.
Yeah, and then, I mean, there's like some surprise receivers getting early draft capital. Like Jonathan Mingo goes in the second to Pittsburgh. Cedric Tillman goes early second to Arizona. So it's kind of like if this happened, then like the value of basically every single rookie pick in Dynasty is going to shoot up. And yeah,
this mock had 8 receivers taken in the third round.
And there was also a lot of running backs taken in the first 4 rounds.
Yes.
Substantial amount, which I think is very enticing as fantasy players. But like Hunter was saying, it's probably best case scenario.
I was shocked when I got Bryce Young at pick 4. Because everyone's talking about him this week, like how he's going to be the number one. Well, at least in the NFL draft, he's going to be the number one pick to Carolina. But
I think in most drafts, like Tony has been saying, we're in the very much of the minority of Anthony Richardson, right? Like that whole plan could fall to shit if he falls out of the top 10, right? If he's out of the top 10, I'm out at 101. I'll just take Bijan, whatever. It is what it is, or I'll trade out of the pick. But I think in most fantasy leagues and Dynasty, Bryce Young is going to be 102, 103 at the very worst.
And so that brings up a question for Hunter. Hunter, you took you took Stroud over Bryce Young. Is that a reflection of the player, the scheme, or both?
A little bit of. So I think like I'm not like the biggest film guy, but I did try to watch a lot of all the quarterbacks, and kind of it seems to me like the only knock on Young is just that he's small and he might break. But like everything on tape, he looks to me like he has the it factor that you kind of want in a quarterback, but my broader take and kind of approach to this in general has been I'm going to really defer to draft capital whenever I don't have like a super strong take, And so, yeah, I mean, Stroud goes ahead of Young in the real draft here. And I'm getting kind of good vibes from Houston with, like, the coaching changes. And it seems like an organization that's trending in the right direction. And Vegas just kind of doesn't know what they're doing, it feels like. Like, they you know, took a swing at trying to get Rodgers to come. And, you know, now, you know, Adams is kind of stuck there, and they're trading away Waller. So it seems like they're kind of like in a weird limbo where they're not really building things the right way. So, you know, feel a little better sticking with the draft capital here. And, you know, it seems like Stroud and Young are both decent bets to be solid quarterbacks. So just, you know,
I think it's a
sticking with the draft. Yeah.
I think you flip a coin. And in this draft, too, Vegas traded up to pick three. So we don't know what kind of assets they gave to surround Bryce Young with. Like, granted, he does have a good offense to play around, but he's playing with Hackett. He's playing with, right? Is it Hackett or is he somewhere else?
No.
Josh McDaniels.
McDaniels, which is even worse.
Yeah. And yeah, so it's, we don't know what they gave up. Where I think following the draft capital situation is the best. If you don't have a preference in quarterback, is the correct brain play to make.
Yeah. And so we, let's see. So we have five first round wide receivers, and that affects our draft picks.
Is they all ripped like immediately.
Right. So Ryan went Bryce Young, which I mean, for 104, I love it. And in most drafts, you're going to end up with Richardson at 104.
Yeah.
If Bryce Young is 104, I don't even, knowing you, I don't think you're going to like even listen to trade offers. You're just going to fucking smash that draft button.
I would think so.
So then I took Levis, you know, because he went fourth overall to the Colts, and we all agree we like that spot, even though Will Levis fucking weirds me out like profoundly.
Read the article on footballabsurdity.com.
Yeah, that's the one. So let's talk, because then we started getting into these wide receivers, right? So we've got 105 after I took Levis. I took Levis over JSN. So Shane went JSN to Tennessee. What do you guys think about Tennessee as a first-round landing spot for JSN?
People hate that place. And I think that's fair on the surface level. But that team is not going to be its identity that it currently is forever, right? Derrick Henry might get traded in the offseason. This is my hot take. It's Derrick Henry gets traded to a Super Bowl winning team. We'll cover that at the end. But that team is going to have a different identity. They have so many holes to fill. But I think giving their quarterback, whoever it may be, in the time filler of Ryan Tannehill to a bridge quarterback, or if they tank for 101 next year, if they can beat Arizona to 101, I think supporting that new quarterback with more than just Treylon Burks is going to be a wait and see. And I will buy the dip. It's not the best landing spot, but I think it's
I hate the landing spot, but if you look at last year's class, you know, all three of the guys that everyone really wants also went to landing spots that were almost a worst case scenario, right? Like, you're stuck with Zach Wilson, you're stuck with Marietta, you're stuck with, you know, all kinds of horrible quarterback situations, and it just doesn't really matter. Like, those guys still showed enough that everybody wants them, and you can't go out and trade the 104 or 105 for them right now. So, like, they can end up in a bad landing spot and not even necessarily have, like, the huge points, and at least in terms of, like, London. And, you know, it seems to me like JSN is in that tier where he's gonna at least show enough that people are still going to want him as like a top 10 or 15 dynasty asset at receiver.
Yeah, I agree with Shane's narrative. That team's going to have some restructuring. Tennessee is going to have some restructuring over the next couple of years, and they're not going to be able to rely on a heavy run game anymore. So they're going to most likely draft a quarterback within the next year or two, and they're going to have to start reintegrating the pass game. And it could be an interesting spot with him and Treylon Burks. That'd be really cool.
I also think, too, we got really spoiled with, like, the Joe Burrow, Jamar Chase, or Tua Waddle cases, where both teams were in weird circumstances due to injury that allowed them to have those top end picks, where I think us relying on top end talent going to good situations is very rare, where unless we kind of luck into those circumstances, I feel like we kind of have to accept the fact that the good players are going to be put on bad teams because they are bad and they have the higher end picks. Like, that's the way the purpose of the draft is, to balance out the overall difficulty level of the NFL, to balance it across all points. So
correct. And so I actually think what you were saying earlier about Hunter, what you were saying earlier about, like, well, we stuck on negative landing spots or negative spots that we perceived were going to be not the most beneficial to these rookies. Zay Flowers at 107 to New England, who's pick 14 overall. I fucking love it. Do you think that he just steps in and gets the Jacoby Myers targets? Is that just the natural state of things?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, especially with these guys that are, like, one of the nice things about this receiving class is that it is all these slot guys that are, you know, doing stuff close to the line of scrimmage, and they can kind of be that. If you've got, like, a bad quarterback or a rookie quarterback, sometimes those guys are less willing to, like, you know, throw up a deep ball and try to, you know, position that. But if you've got this slot receiver that's just breaking people's ankles 5 yards from the line of scrimmage and getting open, they can have those games that's, like, you know, 14 targets, 10 catches, 97 yards, and a touchdown. And that's, you know, beautiful for fantasy purposes. So
gold. Ryan taking Josh Downs at 108, who goes to Baltimore in this mock. I don't think, Ryan, you would make that play with Charbonnet still on the board if we weren't doing a four-person draft. I think this is where you jump on Charbonnet if this was, like, a bigger, like, a league with people, like, for real.
Charbonnet in this mock went to Dallas at pick 90 in round 3.
Let's ask our Cowboys fan, Hunter, how you feel about Charbonnet in Dallas.
I like it. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're getting rid of Kellen Moore, and it kind of sounds like McCarthy wants to run even more. So, like, I've been, you know, kind of more in on Pollard this offseason than I thought I would be, just because it seems like everyone is so terrified they're going to take a running back and he's just going to get relegated. But, I mean, I think there's enough room for multiple running backs to do well enough for fantasy in that offense. And, like, Pollard is just on the franchise tag. So somebody gets drafted there, you know, he could still be gone next year. And whoever ends up there is the feature back. So, I don't know if it's a landing spot where somebody's going to come in and just, like, take over Zeke's role and Pollard's just going to be the scat back again. Like, I really think they do want to use Pollard pretty heavily this year, but, you know, it's still a team that has some, you know, decent offensive line players and wants to run the ball. And it's not a bad landing spot at all.
I would absolutely agree. I think, 108 is probably where Sharps is going to go, and I think that's probably where Ryan's going to end up taking him. He has a 108 type pick. That means that I ended up with Jahmyr Gibbs at 109, second pick 60 to Detroit. Something I'm definitely not complaining about. I ended up taking him over the receivers that were still on the board. So Shane, you went Minnesota's new receiver.
See, with Gibbs, though, I still think you're drafting based on tiers, right? Even though that situation does scare me a little bit, because they have Monty. I mean, Monty's not like a game breaker, but he's going to be like the Jamal Williams role, where their utilization of Swift, whether it be due to injury or whatever, is we're going to have to see what targets are very valuable to us with Gibbs, where we're not expecting him to get 15 carries. We just want meaningful targets, where if he's getting six passes a game, good enough, right? He can put up 100 yards on those passes, and we're fine at a cheaper entry point than Swift was when we originally started. But yeah, I went to Addison because he's my wide receiver 2, wide receiver 3. I have Flowers ranked above him, but obviously the draft capital, like Hunter was saying, is much more important in this instance.
Yes.
Even though I do like Quentin Johnston, I think Addison in Minnesota and he went 2 picks higher, is a good compliment to Justin Jefferson, and he doesn't need any training. He's one of the best route runners in the class, and he's kind of primed and ready to take that slot position and just kind of run wild as a wide receiver too.
Yeah, absolutely. Shane went Jordan Addison at 110, Hunter Tank Bigsby at 111. Is Tank Bigsby someone you're targeting, or is this just kind of a fell in your lap type situation?
Yeah, not at all. I mean, this one, it kind of is about the landing spot and the draft capital. I mean, so in this mock, he goes in round 2, pick 60 to Cincinnati. And I think Cincinnati feels like the best running back landing spot in the league right now, just because Joe Mixon's got all his legal stuff going on, and he's kind of, you know, even before that, it seems like they were kind of ready to move on from him. And, you know, like Samaje Perine smashed while Mixon was out last year. It was just, the offense is so good and the passing game is so scary that I feel like pretty much any running back that's going to get work there is going to be super efficient. So, I think that's a perfect landing spot, and I'm going to want whichever running back ends up there.
Yeah, that pick actually made me really reconsider Tank, because I've talked about how I'm like so middle of the ground with Tank, but like that pick, I saw that and I was like, that is probably one of the smartest plays I've seen in a really long time regarding landing spot and draft capital and his skill set, right? Because he's kind of a do-it-all middle of the ground running back, but I think he fits really well into that system, and they're gonna abuse the hell out of him. And I think 111 is honestly gonna be a steal for him at that spot.
And that's the thing, right? Is like, you watch tape on a guy and you're like, all right, well, this guy's either great or this guy sucks or something. But that's still just one aspect of it, you know? And that situation is just so good that you'll take a guy that might not be your dude. I mean, think about people. I was high on Tyler Allgeier last year. A lot of people weren't. But I was like, look at the opportunity that this guy's going to get to run the ball in an offense that came from Tennessee.
Yeah. Plus, too, like, these running backs are in like similar tiers. Like, you have like your ones, your twos, your threes, but there's a big lump of guys who you can all kind of put together, and it's just based chopping them up based on landing spot and draft capital. You're just picking your poison of, okay, you're the blindfolded C. I'm picking you, right? It is what it is.
And then, so Ryan took Charbonnet, which I think is, like I said, a massive value here given.
Yeah, right.
112. And so I went crazy, and I went Dalton Kincaid at pick 201 because he's the only tight end to get first round. I honestly think if this was a real mock draft, I would probably have gone somewhere else. But, like...
That's tricky. That spot is tricky.
I think Buffalo is an offense that has two consistent fantasy producers, and everything else needs to be seen as, like, the Chiefs right now outside of Mahomes and Kelsey.
And then Kincaid fills that slot role, right? Perfectly.
I wonder if Kincaid, you know, is vaccinated. It's a lot of questions.
Skid Rock coming back, baby.
It really just makes you think, you know? So Quentin Johnson to Shane, that's a round 1, pick 25. That's another one.
I couldn't let it fall, man. I think he, as the draft process goes along more and more, as we get closer to NFL season, I think this is kind of where QJ is going to end up, unless he's like a wildly highly drafted, like in the top 15 in the real NFL draft. I think this is kind of where he's going to slot in based upon people's fear of his athleticism, his route tree, his quote unquote body catching. I mean, we talked about an article today that seems like an easily fixable thing based on the way his game is coordinating right now, where his wide receiver coach basically said that when his feet are planted, he's not really thinking about what he's going to do. So he just relies on his natural tendencies for the safety of the catch, as opposed to when he's in the moment, he's telegraphing his catches with full body extension and then racking up the yards. So I think 202 is a good spot for a ceiling play of this guy could be the best wide receiver in the class. If he's not, I didn't lose an awful amount of draft capital.
Right.
Well, and so the nice thing, sometimes you get these guys where it feels super risky to take them because they're so raw, but in a way, because they're so raw, people are going to kind of grade them on that curve. So, like, Quentin Johnson might come out and not necessarily have the best first half of the season, but he may have, you know, there will be a highlight from the preseason that everyone just goes nuts over, and it's, like, not going to matter what he does because people are just going to think, oh, QJ, you know, he's just got to put it all together, and then it's going to be, you know, a smash. He's going to be a top 10 receiver. So, like, even if he doesn't perform right away, he's going to retain a lot of his value, and you can get out if you feel like.
I think it's like, you know, the risk starts.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I do have a question for you then, Hunter, because you went Devin Achane, who went Cleveland round three, pick 98 at their next pick. And I know maybe that's a Texas A&M thing. If Quentin Johnson was still available there, would you?
Yeah, I think I was kind of hoping Quentin Johnson was going to fall there. And that's even before, you know, seeing some of that stuff that you guys were posting today about, seems like his problems are more fixable. But yeah, I mean, it changed is kind of a fun pick because he's got kind of like he's almost kind of a unicorn, like in his combination of speed, but then also the type of role he had in college. Like he actually did get a pretty big workload and take a lot of hits. And I don't know. He's got it seems like he's got a pretty good ceiling, and then Cleveland's a good landing spot where they've, you know.
Yeah.
They're getting rid of Hunt.
Yeah. And I think we are starting to see more and more teams adapt their playbooks to the skills of the players that they've acquired. And I think, to Hunter's point, I watched a lot of A-Chain. He ran up the middle consistently.
Yeah.
And so I think that he does get most of the passing work, but I think he actually is more involved than Kareem Hunt was last year. So, Ryan, tell us about your pick 204, please.
I went with Michael Mayer.
I love it.
Some good value right there. I was surprised Kincaid went before Mayer. I thought Mayer would be the first tight end, but so that's basically why I went there. I was like, gonna maybe a tight end run or something.
People are cooling on Mayer, man. I think his like 8.8 ROS is just like putting people off. He's not the flashiest, but it's like if you look at production, the dude's still basically the best tight end in the class.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And Green Bay is a great spot, round two, pick 42. It's so funny because, you know, before the combine, Mayer was a lock to Green Bay at pick 15. And now he's a lock to Green Bay at pick 42.
If you can still get him for cheaper, bro, take him somewhere else, right?
Yeah. I went Izzy Abanaconda, Chargers, round three, pick 85. And that's the worst landing spot for Abanaconda for me.
I honestly feel like that's the most cursed location. And I feel bad that you're getting your guy, but with the biggest oh fuck tax.
Yeah.
And that kind of plays into what somebody posted on Twitter or something like, what's the player that, you know, has like that's going to like make people look bad on Twitter or something. I don't remember the exact prompt, but Izzy seems like someone that's got this like cult following around him. And a lot of especially if he ends up with a place like, you know, if he ends up on the Chargers, I feel like he just completely face plant and be somebody that you never hear about again.
It's a Spiller situation. It's a Josh Kelly situation. Like as soon as I saw that mock and I'm like, man, he's going to purgatory.
Yeah. And at 205, I didn't feel too bad about it because there were a lot of options still on the board, but then you went Chargers immediately after me.
Yeah, because even though I believe Jalin Hyatt is the truth, I also think he's going to be a better NFL player than a fantasy player. Yep. And for someone who was mocked 201, 112, potentially 110 in early offseason, if I can get Chargers wide receiver 3, potentially wide receiver 2, if someone gets injured or retires, whatever, at 206, I'm not really too upset about that because they're tied to Justin Herbert, and Kellen Moore is a very, I like his offensive scheme, and I think they're actually going to draft a player to use them how they should be used. Of just, I don't give a shit about his press thing, just let him fucking torch DBs and just let him be scared, right, and then open up the field for other players. So
right.
that was a homer pick, and also Jalin Hyatt's my guy, even though he's not like in my top five anymore, but I gotta get my guy.
Cedric Tillman to Arizona. I'm at the point now where I'm thinking, are we just taking value here, or do we have guys that we still like? Like, Hunter, how do you feel about Cedric Tillman as a player? Are you indifferent?
We're getting down to the range where I don't have any like firsthand takes on most of these guys, and Tillman is somebody that I just feel like I've seen zero excitement about. Nobody is like, oh yeah, Cedric Tillman's my guy. But, and like Arizona is kind of shitty as a landing spot, at least in the short term, while Kyler's out. But, you know, he's the only player left who has a really good draft capital in this mock, the pick 34 overall. And then, I mean, maybe Tillman's somebody that has a little bit of ceiling just because Tennessee ran such a gimmicky offense that maybe he just didn't really get to show some of the things that he can do. And, you know, once he's in the NFL and in a more normal offense, he'll be able to do some of those things. So, at this point, just kind of taking value. Right, exactly. It seems like there's some ceiling there that there's not a lot of left on the board.
That was my Hyatt logic too, is like, even though he was in a gimmicky offense and they only let him really do one thing, if someone's really good at that one thing, he's going to be exploited in an easier system. But exactly like Tillman, if they have a broader skill set that can be exploited, you would expect that an NFL coaching staff would be able to figure out that and scheme their player who they spent high draft capital on to succeed.
So since we're reaching that home stretch of the draft, let's instead focus. I want each of you guys to picks which one you feel strongest about at the position you got them in and why. And I'll have Hunter start.
I'm gonna cheat and just talk about my next two picks because they both sort of feel like eating your vegetables. Like, so Hendon Hooker, 211. He goes to Detroit, round two, pick 55. So like, that's like, at that point, it's just the positional value of, if you end up with a starting quarterback that you got at the back of the second round, that's just such a smash on value. And if Detroit is taking him, that just seems to kind of line up with where they're at with Goff, where like, yeah, he's good enough to win us some games, but, you know, kind of having an eye on somebody who could replace him. And that just sort of lines up with Hooker's timeline. So, you know, getting somebody who would be inheriting an offense with some amazing weapons, that's a pick I feel pretty strongly about. And then Jonathan Mingo, I took him 303. He goes to Pittsburgh, round two, pick 49. Getting a, just, you know, kind of still just following draft capital there. And it seems like Pittsburgh just kind of always takes receivers and then develops them and then lets them walk for their second contract. So that seems like a decent bet in a range where most of my drafts, I'm probably going to be taking running backs and tight ends, but the draft capital is there, so I took that one here.
Yeah, if Jonathan Mingo goes round two, pick 49, I'm hitting the books and I'm going to see what the fuck this is about. Ryan, you have a favorite pick of your remaining picks?
Is your betrayal
208 was purely out of spite.
I love it.
But I was like, well, if I don't take him here, Shane's going to take him. So,
and then I took your guy at 210. So we just traded. It worked out.
Yeah.
Marvin Mims to New Orleans, huh?
Yeah. That'd be a good landing spot actually for him, I think.
I love.
He's wide receiver two there, right?
Yeah. He'd run out of the slot.
Yeah.
And Derek Carr loves the slot. So I think it's a recipe for success, and Ryan's a Derek Carr guy. Honestly, if I couldn't get Mims, I would love Ryan to benefit off of him to support his Derek Carr addiction.
Yeah, it's true. I have a bad Derek Carr affliction. Let's see. He's in a new team this year, so let's see if he can get it done. I did like A.T. Perry.
Uh-oh.
Someone that I kind of fell in love with during the week, and I watched some more film on him.
Wow.
He's 205.
He was the worst graded player I had. I think I was in a bad headspace that day because I literally rated him the lowest out of anybody, and I was like, he's big, he should just play tight end. And that was my review of him.
I was kind of indifferent.
Shane, don't follow the numbers, follow your heart.
All right? It didn't look good. He didn't look good.
Dude, Ryan, I gotta be honest, Sam Laporta to Detroit round cap, like, man,
yeah,
I love me at Iowa tight end.
I had to take Laporta because I do love Iowa football. But
he's Hawk too, baby.
Yeah. Shane, who do you like best of your picks going on?
That's tough, honestly. And I think draft capital is very, very scary here because we know that after like round three, running backs start to fall off the cliff of expectation. But I think Zach Evans going to San Francisco round five, pick 164 is a gamble I was willing to take at 402. Yeah. Very, very low risk. Tajay Spears went round three, pick 76 to New England. Keandre Miller went to round four, pick 105 to Arizona. And I think even though Zach Evans had worse draft capital, I think they're all kind of around the same skill ceiling. And Zach Evans, if something happens to CMC, something happens to Elijah Mitchell, he's going to be in a very high scoring offense that leans on the running game, where I think he has more opportunity in fantasy, even though he will be third on the pecking order or somebody walks, whatever, to have actual fantasy relevance of scoring touchdowns compared to Keandre Miller in Arizona, which is going to be, in my opinion, the worst team in the NFL, and Tajay Spears, because we have no idea how that offense is going to be running with Matt Patricia again.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I really like your Tucker Kraft pick. That, I mean, like this.
I don't know what Miami's going to do. Like, I think it was a steal at 310, but I have no idea what Miami's going to do with the tight end position, because they never utilized Gesicki how he should have been used. So I really don't know.
Well, that was, I mean, I feel like that was really only like last year. Like, he just kind of fell off the earth last year. I mean, he was decent first couple of years.
Yeah.
Well, new system, you know? So,
right. Like, that's true, too.
And a block tight end for 310 at first second round pick at pick 51. That's nothing that I would be upset about.
Right. For me, as much as I like Jalen Reed at Houston as a wide receiver, I got to say my favorite is going to be Sean Tucker at 01. Roshan going to the Bears in this mock at round four is spicy. But and my unpopular opinion is that the Bears don't draft a running back this year.
They shouldn't.
They gave Donta Foreman money. They have Khalil Herbert, and they signed a pass catcher, Travis Homer.
And Justin Fields is RB1.
Right. So Sean Tucker to Kansas City, I think, is great. Isaiah Pacheco is, I think, better than a Jag, but I also don't think he couldn't be surpassed.
I think his game is also limited, and he's a seventh round draft pick. Like, they view him as replaceable based on that capital. Right. Even though he ran angry in the Super Bowl, I think his draft capital kind of speaks volumes to the value of that position. And I think Sean Tucker takes like the Jerick McKinnon role like very well as a pass catcher.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like Pacheco is one of those guys where the film kind of lies to you, because it really pops. Like, he's running so hard, but there's a reason a lot of guys don't look like that are successful, because like they're able to be a little more fluid and change directions and hit holes. So like, yeah, his game just seems very one note to me, and I don't think they're going to, you know, shed any tears over replacing him. But Tony, the pick of yours that I really liked was Butte, because you're getting him in the fourth round. And like, that, this is somebody that before this season, people were talking about like he was going to be like a top five pick or something. So, right. You know, he in this mock, he goes to Atlanta in round five. So it's not a good landing spot or a good draft capital. But like, at this point, everyone is such a dart throw, and somebody who like at one point had the pedigree and was on this trajectory to be like a future star in the NFL, like just rolling the dice that he can sort everything out and get back to that point seems like a better bet than most of the guys we're looking at here.
100%.
And he looks good, and I get a early third for him.
Yeah.
You know, like,
or you get someone who's a believer and you put him in a package, right? He pops for one game.
I never draft to trade.
Yes. That's a stupid philosophy.
So let's wrap it up. We have a segment on the show, Hunter, called Pardon My Gummy. And it's usually a pretty hot take that someone's going to look at you twice and you're going to be like, oh, sorry, like the edibles just kicked in. So usually we have one prepared. So anyone volunteer to go first?
I got mine. I got one from my cowboy boy over here.
All right.
Derrick Henry is traded for a fourth round pick on draft day to the Dallas Cowboys, who win the Super Bowl because of the running game scheme.
Oh, damn. Wow. That is spicy.
That would be really fun to watch. I, as much as I've been hyping up Pollard, I would love to get Derrick Henry in Dallas.
As much as I hate Dallas, I would enjoy watching Derrick Henry play down there.
Derrick Henry get a ring for sure.
Yeah, he deserves it.
Ryan, you got a gummy take for us?
Charbonnet to the Bears. I'm disagreeing with all of your logic.
Okay.
that the Bears will not draft a running back.
Okay. Hunter, you got one?
Yeah. All right. So I think Lamar is still going to end up getting traded, and he goes to Atlanta, and Kyle Pitts is the tight end one for the season.
Oh, no. Shit.
I love that.
I have
Odell's going to be so upset.
He's going to play 3 games. What does it matter?
Yeah, that's true. Oh, my God, Shane, you're so right.
This is my tattoo parlay. He gets traded to the Falcons, Sean McVay retires, and there was like one other one. So if all three of those hit, I'm getting a wizard tattoo because I'm fucking pondering my Orban Ozzy.
All right, so here's mine, and this is based on the mock draft that we just did. Pick number 4 to the Indianapolis Colts, quarterback Will Levis. And my gummy take is if that comes true, Will Levis wins Offensive Rookie of the Year.
Oh, my God.
The power of mayonnaise in your coffee and eating banana with the peels on it, baby.
The guy that posted the mayonnaise in the coffee thing is just a shit poster that's like vaguely affiliated with Bears. He's the one that posted that tweet after the last Bears game of the season. That sucked. Time to jack off.
I almost sniped you on that take. Yeah. I Levis looks super ugly on tape, but like, he's got enough traits, and like, quarterback scouting is so hard that the NFL gets it wrong all the time too. So I'm just kind of rooting for Levis to succeed just because I feel like so many people are like way out over their skis on saying he's for sure going to be a bust and they won't touch him even in the mid-second and stuff like that.
That's all I
exactly.
Want. Prove me wrong. I want my process to get better by showing me where my faults are.
And I want everyone to be good. The league is awesome when everyone's good, especially quarterbacks.
Right.
I don't want to see Tyler Huntley next year.
We'll see him in the XFL.
Yeah, no shit, right? All right, so, hey, that was great. Hunter, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah,
appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Hunter.
Yeah, anytime. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, so come back soon, and we'll call it an episode here. We'll see you back next week. More whatever, I don't know, 79. Cool shit. Later, y'all.
Good night.
Mr. Bean.